All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. We are here on case 11-1677, the State of Ohio versus Derek Warner for the appellant, Nathan McDonald.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Nate McDonald, and I represent the appellate Derek Warner. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. In this discretionary transfer case, the juvenile court transferred 17-year-old Derek Warner to the adult court without making an amenability determination. The two questions presented here are, number one, whether the juvenile court can forego an amenability determination in a discretionary bindover case, and number two, if so, what is required of the juvenile court in order to forego that determination?
But your first proposition is you don't believe that they can waive the amenability.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Your strongest point that you'd like to make?
That is the argument that I'd like to focus on today, although I do believe that Mr. Warner wins on both. But the argument that the amenability hearing cannot be waived is supported by two primary arguments. And the first is that waiver of amenability is not permitted by the plain language of the discretionary transfer statute or Juvenile Rule 30. And the second is that allowing a child to waive the amenability determination is fundamentally inconsistent with the role of the juvenile courts and the purposes of the juvenile justice system. It's undisputed that exclusive subject matter jurisdiction over children lies in the juvenile court. There is an exception, discretionary transfer, and eligibility for discretionary transfer is actually a pretty low bar. All that is required is that the juvenile be 14 years old and be charged by the prosecutor's office with a felony. Therefore, the amenability determination, which is built into the discretionary transfer statute, is a critical point in that fork in the road between juvenile adjudication and adult court, where the child will end up potentially with a felony record that follows him the rest of his life.
Just let's go to some of the anomalies that come from your position in this particular case, because he was found not amenable and transferred to the adult court just a few weeks before in a separate case. And now we have a new case in which the judge has essentially already ruled that this individual was not amenable on a different charge. Could the judge, for example, find that he is amenable to treatment and not transferred on a new charge? So in one case he's over to the adult court, in another case he's in juvenile court. How would that work in your view?
The answer is yes, Your Honor. The two cases could be treated differently because that's the way the statute's written. And in particular, the Ohio General Assembly overruled the state case, this court's 1982 case, State versus Adams, in which this court said that once a child is bound over in one case, the child is bound over in every case after that point.
Mr. Now, McDonald, the problem I'm having with the position you're giving us is that there was a record hearing being held, and counsel asked to approach the sidebar, and the trial court held a sidebar conference off the record with the prosecuting attorney and the defense counsel. And at the conclusion of the sidebar hearing, the court made its decision, an announcement, that there would not be referral to the court clinic, and there would not be any further matters because the court had, as Justice Cupp pointed out, just 6 weeks earlier, determined the client to be not amenable to the juvenile court jurisdiction and bound him over on another charge. So the question I have for you is, there was no objection made by either the defendant, either the juvenile or his defense counsel at that point. And then the matter went to the Common Pleas Court, and an indictment was returned, and there was no motion to quash the indictment. There was no request to return the case to the juvenile court for an amenability hearing. There were no pretrial motions suggesting that the court either lacked jurisdiction or should have transferred it to the juvenile court for a proper determination. There was no objection made throughout the course of the trial proceeding, either on before voir dire or during the trial or at the end of the state's case or at the end of all of the evidence. And the first time it gets raised is on the appellate court as an assignment of error. And my question is, shouldn't this be a plain error analysis because there was no objection? There could have been opportunities to correct it either in the juvenile court and or in the common pleas court.
No, Your Honor, respectfully, because the duty of the juvenile court is clearly set forth in the statute, and it says that the juvenile court must conduct an amenability hearing.
If an error is presented, does defense counsel have an obligation to bring the matter to the court's attention?
No, Your Honor, not under these circumstances. And if you look at the cases,
there need not be an objection to the failure to conduct an amenability hearing.
No, Your Honor, because it's a duty of the court. And in State versus Wilson, State versus Golfin, and also Gaskins versus Shiplevy, all three of those cases state that if the procedures for transfer are not proper, then the case, then the adult court does not have jurisdiction, and the case must be remanded back to the juvenile court. And in each of those cases, there's no reference in any of those cases to an objection that was made in the juvenile court or at any point.
So if error is being committed in this issue, you don't have to raise it to the court. It's preserved.
That's
presumed
correct.
Preserved, is that it? Impliedly reserved? How do you find that our case law on the necessity to bring the matter to the court's attention doesn't fall under the category of either invited error or plain error or waived error?
Because it's a critical phase of the proceedings under U.S. Supreme Court in Kent, and also because it's fundamentally a duty of the juvenile court. And if the juvenile court does not discharge that duty, then jurisdiction does not transfer. And I think the Wilson-Golfin cases are the relevant authority on that point. But it's up to the juvenile court.
Are you seeking then a determination from this court to have this matter remanded to the trial court in the juvenile court division for an amenability hearing and then a retrial?
Well, for an amenability hearing and then whatever happens after that, hopefully.
Well, there'd be a trial either in the juvenile court or in the common pleas court, wouldn't there?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So your view is that the determination and the trial conducted by the common pleas court is what? What's the effect of that legally?
That any convictions related to the trial court proceedings would be vacated.
On what basis?
On the basis that the trial court never had jurisdiction because the juvenile court never made the threshold finding.
The juvenile was never in jeopardy.
That's correct, Your Honor. So
Mr. McDonald, this case is a little different than Wilson because in Wilson the child never appeared before the juvenile court. In this case, and this is where I have to agree with my colleagues, the facts aren't necessarily on your side. It was just 6 weeks before. And having done juvenile bindover proceedings, you get a psychological, you look at their family history, you have a pre-sentence investigation done, you look at their school records. All of those factors go in to determine whether the court believes the juvenile is amenable to rehabilitation. It is not likely, unless there's been some conversion that we've never seen, that the juvenile changed in 6 weeks. And so the court, having just conducted that voluminous amenability determination, should be able to rely that there has been no significant change from 6 weeks prior, and there's been no submission by defense counsel that there has been.
Your Honor, with respect to your first aspect of your question, The distinction in Wilson that you pointed out mm-hmm. does not exist in Gaskins or Golphin. Mm-hmm. So that distinction, this court did not recognize that as a relevant distinction in Golphin. In Golphin, there were proceedings in juvenile court. The transfer proceedings were not proper, and therefore, citing Wilson, this court remanded. So that goes to the first point. The second point is that the amenability, the discretionary transfer statute requires an amenability hearing, and at that hearing, there are 17 factors. 9 of those 17 factors relate to the facts of the case before the court at the time. So the idea that just because he was bound over in a previous case means that he would also be bound over in this case, the facts of the case before the court are critical to that amenability determination, and therefore, it needs to be looked at independently of the first case. Also, the
well, counsel, law... you say that because of some of the requirements of Section E, which may be very different in the second case as opposed to the first. For example, the victim induced or facilitated the act charged. That's the first thing you look at. The child acted under provocation and allegedly committing the act charged, et cetera, et cetera. So they do, I mean, that would argue your point, or support your point about the distinction, and each case stands on its own merits with regards to the bindover. My question is, there's provisions for the waiver of the mental examination in this statute, but there's no provisions for the general waiver as to the amenability hearing per se. Is it contained in any other statute?
No, Your Honor. There are no provisions for waiver of the amenability determination. And it is important to make that clear, that there was no determination here. If you look at the record in this case before this court, there's a bindover order for the case 2 months earlier, and there's a bindover order in the record also for this case. The bindover order from 2 months earlier contains several paragraphs relating to the amenability determination. The bindover order in this case contains none of those paragraphs. No determination was made with respect to amenability.
In fact, the court cited, in citing the court, they said, because the court's already found this alleged delinquent to be not amenable, et cetera, the court will, based on probable cause, which are those factors which they didn't go through and analyze separately, the court, without having another amenability hearing. So the court itself says, I'm not holding another amenability hearing. And so you can't bootstrap and say they actually impliedly had, when the court specifically on the record said, I'm not having one.
Exactly.
Mr. McDonald, would it have been any different if this had been a conviction that we were talking about instead of a pending case in which there had been the bindover?
Yes, Your Honor. If Derek Warner had been convicted prior to the bindover proceedings in this case, then the law would be different. And that's the important point here, is that the juvenile court was operating based on a mistake of law. And it's also important to point out that it's ironic that ultimately that initial case was dismissed on Rule 29. So the case that the juvenile court premised the whole bindover rationale on was ultimately dismissed at Rule 29.
So we have to determine that it's jurisdictional, because if it's jurisdictional, then it's not waivable. And if it's jurisdictional, this is a practice that goes on throughout juvenile courts. These judges are not unfamiliar with many of the young people who appear before them on amenability hearings. If we say this is jurisdictional, then all of those cases then now get appealed and come back for consideration of an amenability hearing.
And it's I understand that as something to consider. But the important point in this case, and the reason that this case is so important, is because it makes the idea that the juvenile justice system and the role of the juvenile court is critical to the idea that the Ohio legislature has put forward, that juveniles are different. And all of the U.S. Supreme Court cases, in addition to this court's cases, that make that clear, that juveniles are different. And we've made a distinction in the way we treat juveniles, because if they are amenable to the rehabilitative efforts of the juvenile court, then that is where they belong. And the idea that bindover should be up to the child is fundamentally inconsistent with that. Children, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, they're not... their ability to, they're susceptible to peer influence.
Counsel, it's not only up to the child. This child was represented by counsel, and all children in this situation are represented by counsel. So it's not a child independently making a decision without ability to, and when I say a decision to waive without the advice of counsel.
That's correct, but the counsel's duty is to represent the legal rights and the expressed interests of the child. If the child is telling the counsel that he would rather be in adult court for a variety of reasons, some of which might make sense. He might receive a lesser sentence. He might receive probation as opposed to...
Okay, so the mere fact that the counsel agreed to a waiver here is not indicative of an indictment on the counsel's performance.
No, not at all, Your Honor. And in fact, that's why it's so important that we recognize this as a duty of the juvenile court to act in the best interest of the child, because no one else in that scenario is acting in the best interest of the child, and the juvenile justice system is premised on the idea that the juvenile isn't necessarily able to articulate and to understand what really is in the juvenile's best interest.
So are you saying that an attorney appropriately conferring with his client and acting on his client's behalf can waive in open court or in juvenile court?
I would say no, because I don't think that it's the amenability hearing is or determination is waivable. But I do, recognizing Justice McGee Brown's point, I do understand that this is happening. And that's why I think it's so important that we recognize this as the duty of the juvenile court. It's only the juvenile court who gets to decide whether the child is amenable to the rehabilitative efforts of the juvenile justice system.
But the question is, can the attorney, in conjunction with his client, in court, after a colloquy by the juvenile judge, waive an amenability hearing?
No, Your Honor.
You're saying no.
That's correct. And if there are no further questions, I would reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Vann?
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, Justice of the Supreme Court. May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Vann. I'm Assistant Prosecutor representing the State of Ohio in this case.
Let me ask you a flip question. Let's say that this case had gone first, before that second case, the earlier case of amenability hearing, was held. And you look at the 9 factors in this case related to the crime. You agree that you look at those factors as part of the amenability hearing?
Correct.
And in those 9 factors, this crime was not that serious. There was hope for the kid to be rehabilitated. Same psychological, same everything else, but the factors are very different. The judge could have found on, I'm not saying necessarily, but this in a hypothetical, the judge could find on one set of facts, the kid's amenable, right?
Correct.
And you could have a second case come up and different factors, same psychological. You just stipulate the earlier psychological, but under the second set of factors, the judge says, under this crime, kid's not amenable, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So when you flip these and now you have a amenability hearing in the first case, the judge makes all these assumptions without going through those 9 factors in the second case, correct? The judge never went through those 9 factors in this case.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, it's not expressly stated.
Well, the judge said, I'm not having an amenability hearing, so I'm assuming the judge didn't go through the 9 factors.
Correct.
We have no way to really evaluate that decision because none of the psychological reports or anything are in this record because no hearing was held. There's nothing in the record that says all those documents were admitted to evidence on this case. They just sort of ignored the whole amenability hearing and jumped right to transfer, correct?
Correct. I think in this case, what had occurred, there was case law in the 8th District discussing the concept of waiving amenability. And granted, this isn't a perfect record. Perhaps if the reports were stipulated, the prior reports were stipulated into this case, the prior psychological reports were stipulated into this case, we might have a very, very different case before us. Mm-hmm. What we do have...
They weren't stipulated. None of that was part of it, correct?
Correct, but and the entire record is for this court, and what is there is a discussion...
It was before the court, for the court to make a bind-over order.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, Your Honor?
What was before this juvenile court in order for the court to order a transfer, a bind-over?
In this case, in this particular case that we're here for, it was a probable cause hearing.
It was a what?
There was a probable cause hearing in this case, and there was a discussion on the record about the prior amenability hearing, in which the prior amenability hearing involved the same judge, same prosecutor, same defense attorney. But I believe those records were not in this case.
Right. So there's no psychological, correct, for this case?
Correct.
There's no, there's none of the other criterion presented, correct? There's no finding by the judge of any of the factors. In essence, what we have is merely a sidebar agreement to waive the hearing and transfer.
Correct, Your Honor.
Off the record, sidebar.
Yes, Your Honor.
No open court colloquy with the child, no representations made by the defense attorney.
That's correct, Your Honor. What we have, we just have the record indicating the sidebar, and there was not a clarification afterward as to exactly what had transpired after sidebar. Only thing we know is afterwards the trial court indicates that there would not be an amenability hearing based on the prior amenability hearing.
Well, Mr. Van, doesn't that sound like the court was referring to the Adams case, where this court did exactly that and said once there's a bind over, for all intents and purposes, there's a bind over in the future? And it sounds like that's what the court ruled in this case.
Correct. Adams was a case about once the child was bound over, the child is bound over for all future.
Right. And the General Assembly has specifically referred to Adams and said, we don't want that to happen. If there's a conviction, yes, but not if there's just a previous bind over.
Correct. But it's the state's position that those amendments that the General Assembly made in response to Adams doesn't take into account the concept of waiver, which is the first propositional law in this case.
And your point is that you believe that there is the possibility of waiving the amenability hearing?
Yes.
And you don't see that as a duty of the juvenile court?
Correct, Your Honor. It's the state's position that what had transpired in this case doesn't render the what occurred afterwards in general division jurisdictional defect. I think that this case needs to be distinguished from the cases like Wilson, as Justice McGee Brown had pointed out. Wilson, what had happened in Wilson was that the child never appeared in front of the juvenile court. That was directly in front of the general division.
What were the child's statements on the record here when the judge asked him about the waiver?
There were no. The record doesn't indicate any statements made by the child.
Or that the judge even communicated with the child. So he might as well not have even been there. This is parallel to the case, the Wilson case. It's like the child wasn't even there.
Yes, Your Honor. While there were no statements made on a record by a child, he was represented by counsel in this case. And counsel representing Mr. Warner.
Are there any statements on the record saying, Your Honor, I've consulted with my client. We, realize we have the right to an amenability hearing. We're waiving that right. You have to recognize that you or put on the record that you recognized your right and what you are entitled to before a waiver is valid. And that's not here. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. There isn't any expanded colloquy other than what appears in the records and the underlying facts in this case. And I think the state does acknowledge that the record we have here isn't the most complete record. There could have been more more on the record. Again, expanded colloquy with the child, perhaps all the reports stipulated to perhaps even a statement that, well, we're going to stipulate to the prior findings in the last amenability hearing. We only have the discussion between defense counsel, prosecutor, and judge, and as noted, the off-the-record discussion.
Is there a policy in your office, Mr. Van, of waiving these hearings on occasion or not?
I believe that waiver can be done by a child.
Let me ask it a different way. See if you can get the answer to this. Does the county prosecuting attorney in Cuyahoga County waive amenability hearings in juvenile court?
I don't think that's for the prosecutor to waive. I think that's that would be something for a defense counsel, too.
Let's try it again. Is it customary to have waiver of these amenability hearings in the juvenile court in Cuyahoga County or not?
I believe it is customary, but how widespread, I'm not aware of how widespread the practice is. Justice McGee Brown did indicate
that. Do you know the practice in other jurisdictions or not?
I believe, I do believe it is a practice that goes on in other jurisdictions. I know there was another case.
So your office does not insist that the hearing must be conducted in every case?
If there is a waiver, it's the state's position that if there's a waiver, there doesn't need to be a full-blown hearing. But, of course, I guess in a sense the standards of waiving what is required to go into a waiver of an amenability hearing is before this court today, but.
Ms. Van, I'm trying to understand the differences in positions here. The public defender maintains there can never be a waiver. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You maintain not only can there be a waiver, but there was one properly done here. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor, in response.
And a possible third position is, because if we don't kick this case out, it affects the future in all cases. A possible third position is there can be a waiver properly done, but this isn't it. It wasn't properly done here. That the judge, at a minimum, needed to say to counsel and to the child, look, you were in here 4 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago. This charge is even more serious. This is not crossing the street at an improper place or some minor charge. This is a serious charge or more serious than the one that I sent you to adult court on. Explore, has anything happened since in the child's life that I would need to be hear about or be made aware of? Review the factors with the lawyer and determine that there is no change, everything's the same, and that the child, upon consultation, desires to waive. That would seem to me to be something along the lines of something that might square with a proper waiver, if waiver is possible. And this seems to come up short.
Correct, Your Honor. That third option is actually a scenario that could occur in this case, because this is on two propositions of law in which the first, Mr. Warner is arguing that there cannot be a waiver. The second proposition of law about the knowing and voluntary waiver is only reached, Mr. Warner argues, if this court holds that it can be waived. So in that sense, we don't reach the knowing and voluntary aspect argument of this case if this court ultimately determines that juvenile court jurisdiction, or at least the amenability hearing, I'm sorry, cannot be waived.
So those are the three choices that we have to consider in deciding this case.
Correct, Your Honor. The three choices
are... Mr. Van, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have another issue along the lines of Justice Pfeiffer. When you look at Appendix 5, the journal entry submitted by the juvenile court judge, I've got a couple of issues. One, it indicates that there was evidence presented, that the legal rights were explained to the child, and then the case was transferred. So I've got a journal entry that does not comport with the record. The court speaks through its journal entries. Then the case is transferred to adult court, but there is no appeal taken of this journal entry that apparently is factually incorrect. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. With respect to the journal entry, when the entry of first evidence being heard, there was a probable cause hearing in this case, and so evidence was received through the probable cause determination. And I believe it's my understanding with bindover orders that typically those do not get appealed, or I think case law holds that those aren't appealed until or unless there's a conviction ultimately under the indictment. So I do not believe that there would have been an appeal.
But it says his legal rights, procedures, and consequences were explained to him pursuant to Juvenile Rule 29.
Correct. From my recollection, that is what the journal entry had indicated.
Thank you.
And just going back
but
to...
But that wasn't what happened.
Right.
You're admitting that. It didn't happen.
Correct. From my recollection, it's there was a probable cause hearing, and then there was a discussion about waiving amenability, then the transfer of jurisdiction in this case.
At the probable cause hearing, are you saying that there was a confrontation between the judge and the child, with the attorney standing next to him, and there was a discussion between the court and the child about the waiver?
No. That's
all right. What happened at the probable cause hearing?
At the probable cause hearing, evidence was presented about the underlying crime itself.
About the crime itself, right?
Correct.
Not about the rights of the child or amenability or anything. It's just, did a crime occur, and is it likely that this child committed that crime? That's all you needed, correct?
Yes, that's what occurred at the probable cause hearing. And just to go back to Justice Pfeiffer's question, yes, it is the state's position that there are three options here, the first being accepting Mr. Warner's first proposition of law and holding that the amenability hearing cannot be waived, the second being amenability can be waived, and it was properly done in this case. And the third option, as Justice Pfeiffer articulated, that amenability hearing can be waived, but it wasn't proper in this case. But it's the state's position that the amenability hearing in this case could be waived because under Juvenile Rule 3, any other right of a child can be waived. And even Kent versus United States indicates this is a statutory right.
So we have to determine whether the amenability hearing is a jurisdictional matter or if it's a right of the child.
Correct. That's the first question before looking at the whether or not it was a proper waiver. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the decision of the 8th District.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald, you've used your time. You may have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Juvenile Rule 3 is irrelevant in this case because this is a duty of the juvenile court and not a right of the child. The amenability discretionary transfer statute clearly states that it is a requirement that the juvenile court must undertake. Second of all, no amenability determination was made in this case. The record clearly demonstrates that. And third, I think it's important on this question of jurisdiction to read a quote from Wilson, which is, quote, absent a proper bindover procedure pursuant to the discretionary transfer statute, the juvenile court has the exclusive subject matter jurisdiction over any case concerning a child who is alleged to be a delinquent. And the Golphin case takes care of this issue related to the fact that the juvenile was not charged in juvenile court in Wilson. With that said, it is true that this third option is available. But Mr. Warner raised his first proposition first for a reason, because it applies clearly in this case and because it is so important to juveniles all over the state of Ohio that we recognize the distinction between juvenile and adult jurisdiction and that we understand the purpose of juvenile courts, that it's a rehabilitative
purpose. The parties can never waive subject matter jurisdiction?
Your Honors, in Kent, Kent does acknowledge that there are certain circumstances where critical phases can be waived. But Wilson applies directly to these circumstances and says without proper juvenile transfer proceedings, the case has to be remanded. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions.